Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. If you count the votes as cast, Democratic incumbent State Supreme Court Justice Allison Riggs won re-election. Her margin of victory was slim, but according to the count, she won. That was 2.5 months ago. Since then, there have been two additional bipartisan recounts, and each time, she surpassed her Republican challenger, Judge Jefferson Griffin, by 734 votes. And because those recounts gave no indication that enough discrepancies existed to reverse the outcome, the State Board of Elections ruled against ordering a full statewide hand-to-hand recount. She won. But Griffin continues to challenge the outcome. He asserts 60,000 ballots were cast by voters who were improperly registered. He also says some ballots should be discarded because they were cast by ineligible voters who live overseas. After the State Board of Elections dismissed that challenge, Griffin turned his attention to 5,509 ballots, most of which come from heavily Democratic counties. The outcome of this election will soon be in the hands of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. Oral arguments will be heard on Monday, just 2 weeks before the North Carolina Supreme Court is scheduled to begin their new term. This is a complicated case and one with far-reaching implications depending on the outcome, so we're going to spend this hour exploring it. Rusty Jacobs is with us. He is the voting and election integrity reporter at WUNC in Chapel Hill. Miles Parks is a Washington correspondent who also covers voting for NPR in Washington. And John Corzine is associate professor for legal writing and director of the Appellate Advocacy Clinic at the Wake Forest University School of Law. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Mike.
Mike.
Morning.
Morning. So, Rusty, let me begin with you. Before we delve into the minutia of all of this, did I explain the crux of the dispute over this vote count relatively accurately?
Yes, Jefferson Griffin has postponed the outcome, ultimate outcome in terms of the vote count by filing protests over the reasons, the allegations you discussed, incomplete voter registrations in more than 60,000 cases, more than 5,500 ballots cast by military and overseas voters covered by a federal law that has provisions for those kinds of absentee voters, and then a smaller number of people who allegedly never resided in the state of North Carolina but are registered to vote here. Those protests were reviewed and dismissed by the State Board of Elections. Jefferson Griffin then went to the courts but has tried to circumvent the typical appeals process and go directly to the state Supreme Court.
If the count is correct, and we have all reason to believe that it is correct, the margin of victory is 734 votes. That's very small for a state of our size with the number of people who participated in this election. But is that 734 vote margin of victory so unusual for our state that it calls for all of these numerous challenges? Rusty?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. The state Supreme Court issued a decision late yesterday saying that Jefferson Griffin had to go through the typical appeals process. That is, in the state courts, start with the Wake County Superior Court, have his case heard there, then go through the appeals process, and then ultimately, perhaps, take it to the state Supreme Court. He had been trying to go directly to the state Supreme Court. Chief Justice Newby, conservative justice, Republican, who heads the state Supreme Court, wrote in his opinion on the order saying that Griffin had to go through the typical appeals process, said there is nothing undemocratic about questioning the legitimacy of votes. And I'll note, too, this is not so unusual because just in 2020, Justice Newby beat Sherry Beasley, his predecessor as Chief Justice, in a race that came down to just over 400 votes.
401 votes. And the question is, did the Democrats protest that?
Well, Sherry Beasley had some protests, but after two recounts, I believe it was two recounts, confirmed Newby's lead, she abandoned all her protests and conceded. That is not what has happened here.
Miles, ever since Donald Trump refused to concede the 2020 election, we have been seeing ramped up efforts to essentially follow that playbook, especially by Republicans. You report on election outcomes and any fallout they may engender nationwide. How unique is this situation we're experiencing here in North Carolina?
I think what's so interesting, Mike, is that this case in North Carolina really is what we, as somebody who's been covering this stuff for the last 7 years, what I was expecting to see nationwide. But because of the outcome, Donald Trump winning the popular vote and an electoral college sweep, we really did not see it in big, high-profile races. But it does look like, exactly like you said, this playbook that we had been seeing kind of get pieced together post-2020, the coordination efforts over the last few years, coordinate efforts to kind of come up with theories around elections and get activists on the ground kind of working on this stuff that then kind of feeds into all of these legal challenges after the fact. This playbook is very reminiscent to what we saw in 2020, but this race is actually unique this cycle because, by and large, across the country, most voters trust the election results this time around. There haven't been the same level of conspiracy theorizing at the national level, but this race is kind of, I think, it to me, signals the future of election denialism, that anyone who thinks this kind of idea is dead just because Republicans and Democrats trust the process this time, I think this race to me says no, like that idea needs to, we need to pump the brakes on that idea.
Rusty.
So on election night, before any results were official, Jefferson Griffin, the Republican candidate for the state Supreme Court seat, was leading Allison Riggs by around 10,000 votes, which is the margin for a recount. Nonetheless, it was a pretty sizable gap compared to what has happened. But I'll note that Chief Justice Newby, in his opinion, the order issued last night saying that Griffin has to go through the appeals process, went to great lengths to say that Jefferson Griffin's protests are not undemocratic and that seeing a 10,000 vote gap on election night change to a 734 vote deficit is unusual, which unfortunately invites people to have less trust or mistrust the process. The State Board of Elections has been clear. No results on election night are official. There is 10 days of a canvass period where counties review provisional ballots that have been submitted, absentee ballots that have to be validated. Only then, after that canvass process, is the result final. That's what happened. But Chief Justice Newby's order suggests there is something unusual enough in that change from a 10,000 vote lead to trailing by 734 votes that it's worth reviewing.
Miles, you cover this nationwide. Is this unusual? We know that on election night, as the votes come in and we all watch it on television and we see the tallies change, go up and down and up and down, and it gets tighter and wider and tighter and wider. But until they count the absentee ballots, until they count the some of the late ballots that come in on election day, that sometimes in some states cannot be counted until after the polls close, they can't be pre-counted. The totals will change over time, and sometimes they pan out over several weeks, as was the case here. Is this something relatively new? This has always been the case if you followed elections. Why suddenly are we so concerned about the election totals changing from what they were at 11 p.m. on election night?
I think there is actually something. The heart of the matter is kind of true in that elections are closer right now than they have been in like over a century. If you actually look at across the country, margins are really, really tight in a way that they have not been by some metrics since right around the Civil War. And so we are a very, very tightly contested nation. And when elections are decided by whether it's 400 some votes, 700 some votes, the odds that a statewide race would have the leader change over the time of that ballot counting is higher now probably than it would have been a few years ago. But that's only a reflection of how close the election is. That's not a reflection of anything changing on in terms of the counting, right? Like that, all of that is normal. And I would actually add the other aspect of this to me that is different. In the week or two after the election, it is completely normal for a losing candidate to file legal challenges that question the results. And in many cases, those challenges are baseless the moment they are filed. On both sides, I will say that this happens right around the election time where a losing candidate is kind of grasping at straws to find a way to see if they can impact the results in some way, shape, or form. That is not that uncommon in that early November period. What's really weird is that this certification has been pushed back. The longer this goes, that is where this starts getting into unprecedented territory. That the fact that we're a couple months after the election and this still isn't decided, that is how we've kind of entered this kind of new zone.
So John Corzine is with us. He's an associate professor of legal writing at Wake Forest University. He's the lawyer here on the panel. This particular case, Miles just talked about losing candidates sometimes grasping at straws to try to overturn their opponent's victory or to eke out a victory over their opponent, is not unusual. But he's been grasping at many different straws. That straw didn't work. Let me try this one over here. Is that an accurate summation of what he's trying to do here or what he's been trying to do here?
Yes, it is. And to follow up something that Rusty said earlier, in the Beasley election, which, as you noted, Mike, was decided by only 401 vote difference, that case was all ended as of December 18 in 2020. I looked back to see, and it was all dropped and certified by December 18. Here we are more than a month later, and this one is, you know, still ongoing.
So, as we have said, protesting the outcome of an election or contesting the outcome of an election is perfectly valid. It's perfectly legal to do. From what you can tell with the way this election was conducted and the rules as they were set up prior to the election, John, was this election conducted fairly? Has the complaint process been handled fairly?
Yes, it all seems to be by the book and above the board. And just for our listeners' sake, you know, folks should not have any doubts about our election system. The folks who run our elections are very good at what they do, very nonpartisan, very accurate. If you work the polls, which I did four times during the voting, five times counting election day and four early voting days, it's very professionally handled. And this one was also by the book. And so, by all accounts, it should have been wrapped up in mid-December, well, also like the Beasley newbie race.
You and others on this program and elsewhere have pointed to the fact that our elections are the fairest and safest and most equitably functioning elections perhaps in the world, and yet in recent years they've all been called into question. We keep hearing about the need for election integrity when in fact our elections have more integrity than most in the world according to some sources. Why is that in dispute?
So, you know, Rusty alluded to something filed in state court late yesterday. I want to talk about something filed in the Fourth Circuit late yesterday. It was an amicus brief by a group of scholars from around the country, from places like University of Chicago and Harvard and several others. And they're all scholars of something they call democratic backsliding. And it's a very effective brief, I thought, about what they are finding, not just in the United States, but throughout the country with sort of a move towards sort of totalitarianism and fascism. And the point they make is, you know, democracies slide sort of imperceptibly and gradually over time. And North Carolina right now is sort of on the verge. And so it's, you know, the broader scheme of things is that this is not unique to North Carolina. It's kind of a trend, but it's something that can gradually come upon you to where you've got, you know, a government where there aren't checks and balances. And so that's the danger here.
And sowing distrust in institutions, sowing distrust in our elections, in any elections, is part of what autocrats do, what dictators do to undermine democracies around the world. And this is seemingly coming from one party. Not necessarily, the Democrats don't seem to be participating in this as much as Republicans. And we can look into that as we go through the program. I also want to go concentrate when we come back on the 60,000 votes that have been challenged, who those voters are and why they are in question. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the fact that the election for the one seat on the North Carolina Supreme Court, which was won, according to the multiple recounts by Allison Riggs, the Democratic incumbent on the court, is still being contested. And on Monday, it will go for oral arguments to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. Rusty Jacobs joins us. He is the voting and integrity, election integrity reporter for WUNC. Miles Parks is a Washington correspondent and someone who reports on voting integrity for NPR. And John Corson, who we have temporarily lost, will hopefully be returning. He's an associate professor of legal writing at Wake Forest University. So since John is not here, Rusty, explain to me the problems that Jefferson Griffin is alleging surrounding the 60,000 votes that he initially challenged. What is he saying is wrong with them? What makes them illegitimate?
And he's challenging ballots in three categories. He's mentioned the 60,000. He's challenging the biggest number of ballots cast by voters he alleges were improperly registered and therefore ineligible to vote. That's the biggest pool. The second biggest pool is the more than 5,500 ballots cast by UOCAVA voters. Those are, it's the Uniform and Overseas Citizens Absentee Ballot Act. Those are could be military deployed. They could be deployed stateside, internationally. They could be missionaries, foreign service workers, and members, family members of those kinds of people. And then there's a smaller number. We could talk about that later. And I'll note, before I go into the 60,000 people who were allegedly incompletely registered, Jefferson Griffin and his attorneys have really shifted the thrust of their case to the 5,500 UOCAVA ballots. That being said, the issue with the 60,000 allegedly incomplete voter registrations, in 2002, the federal government passed the Help America Vote Act, HAVA. It turned out that the North Carolina State Board of Elections until last year had been using a registration form that didn't quite comply with that federal statute in that it did not clearly indicate a person's driver's license number or last four digits of their social security number was required information. It was requested, but it hadn't been blocked off and put in red ink on this form. That's been corrected. That's also been looked at by the State Board of Elections, who determined that there was no reason to purge any voters who may have used that outdated registration form from the voter rolls in North Carolina. These are people who registered a long time ago, had been through many election cycles, have had to present ID of one kind or another, even before the photo ID law went into effect in North Carolina. So there was just no reason to determine that these people were ineligible.
Mr. Griffin's or Judge Griffin's lawyer, in filing their brief, they cited precedent for disqualifying these ballots. They wrote, quote, "This case presents a fundamental question. Who decides our election laws? Is it the people and their elected representatives or the unelected bureaucrats sitting on the State Board of Elections?" There's deepening criticism, Miles, of the bureaucracy from the federal government on down. Donald Trump refers to them as the deep state, but at all levels, we have agencies and boards selected by our elected representatives who pass rules and regulations and administer certain aspects of what government oversees. If a court decides in favor of Griffin's argument that unelected bureaucrats should not decide election laws, what are the broader implications of that?
They would be far-reaching. I think I think it's important to kind of take a step back and look at all of these challenges through timing also, because each of these individual questions, like all things with elections, you can argue over the rules. There's really it's just a question of when you're doing it and how you're doing it. And so these were all issues that if Mr. Griffin truly had an issue with how the election was going to be administered, it was apparent that these 60,000 people were missing this data on their registration, on their registrations before the election. And in fact, a lawsuit, if I'm correct, Rusty, related to these registrations was already adjudicated earlier in the year and failed to make it so these people could not vote. And the UOCAVA rules have been in place for years, as Rusty mentioned. And so the most unprecedented nature should these challenges be successful to me would be this idea of changing the rules after the game has been played. And so I think that is what the kind of election experts that I talk to, the legal experts I talk to, are watching for, because that would be really taking us into unprecedented territory, is adjusting the rules after the result is known.
I was going to ask John Corzine, who's the lawyer on the panel, who's not yet rejoined us, whether that would set precedent. It would be precedent setting. Is that what you're saying, Miles?
At least, you know, there would be, I think it would open up a lot of other doors, I guess, legally. That my understanding is that this could be a legal fight, especially if this election were overturned, that is not going away anytime soon. Is that your understanding too, Rusty?
Yeah. So the state Supreme Court, as you know, is solidly conservative. It's a 5-2 majority for conservative justices. But one conservative on that court, Justice Dietz, Richard Dietz, has expressed a lot of the concerns you're talking about, Miles, in this order that was issued last night saying that Jefferson Griffin has to go through the typical appeals process. Justice Dietz said that his problem, that is Jefferson Griffin's problem and the Republicans' problem by extension, is with state law. And there are forums to discuss that and debate that, the legislature, there's advocacy. But these voters, by and large, the voters that are being challenged, followed the rules that were in place. The question and complaints that Jefferson Griffin and Republicans are raising have to do with a policy discussion, but that policy discussion should not be decided in a way that would disenfranchise voters who absolutely follow the rules.
To be clear, and it's been said many times on this program and elsewhere, it is perfectly legal to challenge the outcome of an election. And in fact, if you are the candidate who loses and you truly feel that there's something wrong, you probably have an obligation to your constituents to challenge the outcome of the election. So what he's doing, Jefferson Griffin is doing, is perfectly legal and perfectly valid. But there have been op-ed columnists and letters to the editor that I've read in the papers over the past several months, Rusty, that question the judgment of Judge Jefferson Griffin because of his willingness to evidently, apparently, politicize this and to bring politics into the outcome of this, as opposed to just saying, well, I lost, it's over. Are those criticisms valid, or are they equally political?
Look, I think that politicians, office seekers, do have an obligation to their constituents, but that obligation includes the obligation to be honest and to bolster people's faith in the process, if the process is truly trustworthy. And I in my reporting on a lot of the law changes that have happened at the North Carolina General Assembly that have narrowed access to the ballot, that have done away with the grace period for counting properly postmarked ballots. Recently, the legislature passed a law that gives people less time to correct problems with their provisional or absentee ballots before the canvass, the official count for elections. All those issues, if those laws are provisions that these politicians truly support, I think they have an obligation to remind people that while these policies are being put in place, they're not being put in place because there is a rampant fraud problem. And you don't hear those statements. And so I think the obligation to constituents goes beyond just fighting for a win at all costs.
That's the other thing that I would just add, Mike, is I think this conversation would be really different. I think you'd still have the timing issue of talking about the rules after the game has been played. But if there was evidence that these voters that we're talking about were ineligible in some way, I think there would be a broader conversation over whether it's worth revisiting. But there has been no evidence that any of these people were ineligible voters. So I think, it just loses a lot of credibility.
Removing voters from the rolls is becoming a tactic used ever more frequently around the country, especially by Republicans. In August of last year, the state GOP here in North Carolina, along with the Republican National Committee, attempted to purge 225,000 voters who had neither a driver's license nor a Social Security number listed in the state's database. So remind us, Rusty, were they successful in that attempt?
No, and Miles mentioned that, referred to that case. That was, in fact, reviewed by a federal district court judge.
So since that effort failed, why does Jefferson Griffin expect to be successful by essentially using the same argument against this first the 60,000 votes we've been talking about and later the 5,000 votes he's now seemed to be focusing on?
And I'll go back to something I said. In fact, perhaps this tactical shift by Jefferson Griffin and his attorneys to focus more to ask the state Supreme Court to take up first and separately the issue of the 5,500 UOKAVA ballots may be an indication that he doesn't feel a great deal of confidence in winning the argument over the 60,000 ballots on the registration issue. He will tell you in his briefs, say clearly that he believes this comes down to election integrity and that any ineligible voters allowed to cast a ballot cancels out the vote of a legitimate voter. So he is persisting in saying that this is about preserving election integrity when, as Miles said, there's no actual evidence of voter ineligibility. It's just a policy argument.
I mentioned in the open to this program, Miles, that Griffin's challenge seems to target, or at least would result, in more Democratic voters' ballots being thrown out than Republicans. Western Carolina University political scientist Dr. Chris Cooper did an analysis of those challenged votes and found, quote, challenged voters are younger, more likely to be from out of state, more likely to identify as a member of a minority group, and much more likely to have unidentified race, gender, and ethnicity. And in December, a Raleigh News and Observer analysis found that Black registered voters were twice as likely to have their ballots challenged by Griffin's protest than white voters. Does this seem particular to North Carolina, or is this part of a pattern being repeated in various places nationwide?
I think we see it as part of a pattern nationwide. I think one of the things that this brings up is there is still a really big partisan difference between how people vote right now in the U.S. in terms of whether they vote by mail and vote early versus vote in person. Generally, since 2020, Republicans have voted in person at higher rates than Democrats, and Democrats have used mail voting. But what we're seeing across the country, and in this case as well, is that allows for a kind of targeting of those sorts of mail ballots that you can, in many cases, Republicans have the ability to challenge votes that almost certainly are going to be favorable for Democrats without coming out explicitly and saying that those are the votes that they are challenging when, you know, we know from patterns that by challenging early in mail votes, you almost certainly are targeting the ballots of people whose votes are not going for the candidate.
Through the vagaries of the internet, John Corzine is back with us from Wake Forest University. Nice to have you back. John, everybody's entitled, as we said many times, to challenge the outcome of elections and to use the courts to do so. In fact, that is the way you do it. This case is, however, ping-ponged between state and federal courts. And on Monday, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, the federal court, will hear this case. Is this case breaking any new ground in terms of the apparent relentlessness of the challenges, or in terms of the legal theories being used to argue in favor of Jefferson Griffin winning?
Well, it is certainly unusual, as we've alluded to already, about how long it has lasted. And the theories, some of them are kind of groundbreaking. A little bit about what will happen Monday. The court is coincidentally hearing cases Tuesday through Friday of next week. So they were already going to be in Richmond, all these judges. And so they've scheduled this case for Monday afternoon at 3:30. And so come Monday evening, we will have a much better indication of what's likely to happen in the Fourth Circuit. Often the questions from the judges give a clear indication of what they're thinking or what they're struggling with. And so come Monday night, we'll have a much better idea what the Fourth Circuit will, how they'll see this case, whether they're going to step in and take action or agree with the lower federal court judge to send it all back to state court. So we really won't even know who the three judges deciding the case are until Monday. So there are some things up in the air about what'll happen at the Fourth Circuit.
Miles, some of the some of Griffin's legal theories for throwing out votes in this election apparently originate with the conservative activist group Election Integrity Network, which was founded by Cleta Mitchell. She is a former Democrat turned Republican who helped Donald Trump in his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. And she was in the room on the call to Georgia when he asked the Secretary of State there to find him sufficient votes in Georgia for him to win that election. Griffin is behind in this race after two recounts, as we've said, by 734 votes. If he is successful in challenging the 5,000 votes that he is now targeting, most of which are from Democrats, he will likely win. How is this effort different from Donald Trump's attempt in Georgia in 2020 to find votes?
It seems very similar on its face. I mean, I would say one difference would be I don't think Jefferson Griffin has been as outward. Most people are not as outward with their kind of accusations about the election system as Trump was in 2020. So Trump kind of had that going for him at the same time, where he was at the same time filing legal challenges while also giving speeches that were kind of to thousands and thousands of people, pushing in the court of public opinion a lot of these ideas, whereas Griffin is really focused on using a lot of these fringe far-right election conspiracies in the legal realm, but has really said almost nothing publicly, if I'm correct, about the election's integrity. But, you know, this is an example of how this Election Integrity Network that Mitchell started, which in 2020, I mean, it didn't exist. And so you see Donald Trump's lies in 2020, Cleta Mitchell kind of took them and created an organized network that exists in states all the way across the country. I believe they're in all 50 states now, where they basically have local chapters that meet and talk about election fraud and what they see as election integrity issues. And the North Carolina, really the EIN, as they call themselves, is most active in the places where conspiracies are most active, and that happens to be the swing states right now. So North Carolina's chapter has been shown to be a pretty active EIN chapter.
Rusty, I've got 30 seconds. Any evidence that the Election Integrity Network or Cleta Mitchell or both are personally or intimately involved in this fight back and forth, or are they just using a page from the playbook, or is it just coincidental that it looks that way?
I mean, I haven't seen any evidence. I haven't looked into it, and I'm not aware of any direct involvement of the Election Integrity Network. But that, like Miles said, there is a playbook out there, and there are ways of challenging the system and promoting the sense that there is something not to be trusted. And that's under.
We're going to talk more about election integrity and the need or no need to bolster it in a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the case between Allison, the contest, the election outcome between Allison Riggs, the incumbent Democrat on the state Supreme Court, and her challenger, Republican Jefferson Griffin. The case goes to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals on Monday to hear arguments to decide who will be the winner of this. Rusty Jacobs is with us. He's the voting and election integrity reporter for WUNC. Miles Parks reports on voting as a Washington correspondent for NPR, and John Corson is associate professor of legal writing at the Wake Forest University. As I understand it, John, Judge Griffin did not challenge the vast majority of overseas and military voters who cast ballots in North Carolina, and he has declined to explain why. He seems to be targeting only Democratic strongholds in these 5,000 votes that he wants to have called into question. Is that likely to factor into the arguments from the other side on Monday at the Fourth Circuit Court?
I think very much so there's a number of things the other side's disagreeing about. I think that'll be one that they focus on for sure. And one of the main disagreements is, does the case even belong in federal court? And so I think that's one disagreement, is where does this case belong? And then the second one is, should the election results be certified? And so there are a lot of sub arguments there in there. But the main one is, does this case even belong in federal court? And then if so, what should the outcome be? And,
so if the federal court kicks it back to the state, John, which court in the state will get it?
Well, based on the order yesterday, it's going to start in Wake County Superior Court, which is where these where it ordinarily would go, and not directly to the state Supreme Court. So Judge Griffin was trying to get it to be heard initially directly in the state Supreme Court. But it looks like it would instead end up being in Wake County to start with, a trial court in North Carolina.
Rusty, even if Griffin's arguments are not based in politics, but instead based on his sincere belief that some voters weren't qualified to vote or that rules were broken, it certainly appears to be political to a vast number of citizens out there. How does that comport with his campaign promise to, quote, apply the law as written once on the high court and to remove politics from our courts?
I'll just say that the law, from the briefs I've read from both sides, the law seems to be clear. For example, let's take these 5,500 ballots, UOKAVA ballots filed by military and overseas absentee voters. Nothing in the federal law contains a provision requiring the presentation of photo ID. That is a law now in effect for the general electorate in North Carolina. But after reviewing the federal rules and the instructions, the State Board of Elections used its administrative authority to adopt a rule that says clearly UOKAVA voters do not have to present a photo ID. That rule, by the way, had to go through a review process and was ultimately approved unanimously by the Rules Review Commission in North Carolina, which is a body of 10 members appointed by the Republican leaders of the state legislature. That's what resulted in the rule that was applied. So when it comes to applying the rules, one would think it's clear that until something changes, UOKAVA voters do not have to present a photo ID. Right. I'll also point out that Jefferson Griffin cast UOKAVA ballots, according to reporting from ProPublica, in 2019 and 2020, when he was deployed with the North Carolina Army National Guard. Now, there was no photo ID law in effect yet because of litigation. Nonetheless, these are ballots he's familiar with.
John, you wanted to chime in.
Yes. One thing I wanted to be sure to point out as in talking about the details about this case, when the state Supreme Court voted 2 weeks ago to block the certification of the election, it was by a 4-2 vote. And one of the dissenting judges, justices, a Republican justice, Richard Dietz, wrote an opinion I really liked and an informal poll of friends thought was sort of the best take on this whole case. And Justice Dietz said, even if there might be some merit to the overseas challenge, it's really too late to bring this up. And he said the state Supreme Court should just should stay its hand now and let the election be certified. And he said, once people are actually voting in the election, it's far too late to challenge the laws and rules used to administer that election. And he relied on a couple of U.S. Supreme Court decisions and a couple of state Supreme Court decisions and something called the Purcell principle that is basically, when it's this far along, you shouldn't change the rules after the fact and try to throw votes out. And I hope that idea of his gets adopted either by the state courts or by the Fourth Circuit to say it's just too late to try to change the rules in the game. A lot of people voted and want their votes to be counted. They did nothing wrong. They followed the existing law. And so I think that Justice Dietz's opinion is my favorite out of all the things I've read in these two cases.
If they decide to the contrary, if they say it's okay to change the rules after the fact, what does that do to everything? Is this just Katie open the door and let anything happen? No, there are no rules anymore?
Well, it certainly undermines confidence, not just by voters. Think about all the money these candidates are having to spend, right? This is a disincentive to public-spirited people to run for office if they think the rules are going to be changed after they put in all this work. And think about how hard it is to campaign for a statewide office in North Carolina. We are a 100-county state. It's very expensive just to run. And then if you have to spend thousands of dollars in court afterwards. So it's going to be a disincentive to the quality of people interested in running for office, much less the voters lose undermining confidence of the voters. So it's a real problem going forward.
And that runs counter to what the Republicans say they are trying to do with their focus on election integrity. They want to restore trust in our election system. And it seems to me that would do the opposite. Republicans at the state and at the national level, Miles, have been working diligently, intently on election reform. Much of it, of the perceived need, is based on the perception that the 2020 election was stolen. It was not. Those same Republicans had no problem in that election with down-ballot races that would have been affected had the election been invalid or somehow rigged. Yet already this year, you report that one Texas congressman reintroduced legislation that you report, which would be aimed at stopping non-citizens from voting in federal elections, something that is already illegal. Is there any evidence that this occurs on any meaningful scale, or that this legislation would stop it if it did?
There is not. And there are kind of two competing interests right now that I'm going to be watching over the next couple of years within the Republican Party. There is the Chip Roy, who is the Texas Republican you mentioned, represents the sort of Cleta Mitchell wing of election denial within the Republican Party that is organized and still very energized by the 2020 election and still feels like there is rampant fraud despite no evidence in the election system. At the same time, the restrictions that Mitchell, Roy, many of the kind of restrictive-minded elections folks in the Republican Party are pushing for, research has shown that those impact low propensity voters the most. The voters who only vote every once in a while, who maybe decide a week before the election that they're going to vote. These are not the diehards who are voting in every primary. And yet, Donald Trump won low propensity voters in 2024. They propelled him to his victory. And so for a long time, Democrats have won low propensity voters very consistently, which made the incentive structure very simple for many Republicans, that if you were to restrict, make voting slightly more difficult, then it could have some helpful political results in really close races. That does not seem to be the case right now. If you were to restrict those low propensity voters, almost certainly Donald Trump would not have won the 2024 election. And so it will be very interesting to see how those two forces collide, the people who are committed to the idea that there still is fraud and there still need to be more restrictions versus the strategists who are saying, if we restrict some of the low-income, low-education voters who this has been, these policies have been shown to impact, that will hurt our party.
NPR obtained audio of an elections panel that Cleta Mitchell led late last year. She is with the Election Integrity Network that we've talked about in this hour. And she led this elections panel for state lawmakers at a meeting of ALEC, that is the American Legislative Exchange Council. They, like the Heritage Foundation, have conservative fingers in a lot of different pies. How did you get access to that recording, and what does it reveal?
So we got access from a watchdog group called Documented, which it was a secret recording. Somebody in the room passed it along to them. We were able to verify that that it was an accurate recording. We were able to listen to the entire thing. We didn't just get snippets. What it reveals is that the folks who are energized by the 2020 election are not satisfied with the fact that the 2024 election seems to have gone really well, that, you know, wide majorities, 90% of voters right now say they trust that the election was administered well and fairly in 2024. You would assume that that would mean that people who think the world was on fire in 2021 and 2022 would say, okay, maybe either things got fixed or things are getting better. That is not the case based on when you listen to a private meeting of these sorts of folks. These are people who still, like you said a second ago, think non-citizens are voting in mass and that more rules need to be put in place to stop them, despite there being no evidence of that. The other big picture thing that I'm going to be watching for this year that came up in the panel that I had not heard very much before is that these people are really worried about protections for election workers, that many states since 2020 have seen an uptick in threats against voting officials. But on this panel, these folks in the Election Integrity Network view those sorts of protections, giving election workers for instance, more penalties for assaulting voting workers, they do not want lawmakers to be passing laws that do that, because it pushes, in their eyes, this narrative that election workers have been under threat since 2020, which they do not believe to be true, despite, you know, we have reported on it for years. There have been arrests based on people threatening voting officials. It's been widely reported and kind of seen as true that Donald Trump's lies in 2020 led to this uptick. But there's a lot of rewriting of history going on right now, and this seems to be part of that.
On this tape that NPR obtained, Cleta Mitchell says, quote, "We want election systems in which the great majority of voters trust the result of every election, even if they don't like the outcome, because they are persuaded that the process is lawful and that it is transparent, so the voters can be confident that the results are accurate." Wasn't that the case for most citizens when it came to every election until Donald Trump lost in 2020 and he and others raised these false claims that the election then was rigged and stolen?
Yes, and I think the most interesting thing about the 2024 election is there is this huge amount of trust right now in the 2024 outcome. And many voters still say the 2020 election was stolen. But when you talk to voting officials, many of whom have been in the job for close to a decade or two decades, the administration of these two elections was not different. Yes, in some cases, election officials spent more money or more time educating voters on the processes. Maybe they increased transparency that voters were asking for. Maybe they let more people into different rooms, or, you know, there were efforts to kind of make their processes more well understood. But there is no evidence that the administration of the election was any different, despite this kind of disparity in trust.
So, John, if Jefferson Griffin is successful in challenging the validity of 60,000-plus votes or the 5,000 votes that he seems to be focusing on, it is reported that at least 21 elected officials would be among those affected by any change in the outcome of that race, because if that race has to have votes eliminated from it, other races that have already been determined, people have taken office, would also be affected. What would happen then? Would they have to step down, run again for re-election? What would happen then?
Well, that's one of the puzzling things that would be up in the air. Though one school of thought is those have been certified at this point by the State Board of Elections. It would be very odd to reopen them at this point. So it might be confined purely to this one seat on the Supreme Court. But I did want to talk about that for a second, why that seat is so important. Until 2022, there was a 4-3 Democratic majority on the Supreme Court, and the court ruled against partisan redistricting. And but then at the election, the court's balance switched to 5-2 Republican, and they revisited and throughout the decision the same court had made just a few months earlier. And so one thing underlying this and why these seats are so important is they really affect partisan redistricting. The U.S. Supreme Court has said federal courts aren't going to get involved with partisan redistricting. It's up to the states. And for North Carolina now, that means unless the state Supreme Court fixes partisan redistricting, and gerrymandering, we're going to be stuck with a very extremely gerrymandered state legislature for the foreseeable future.
But if he wins, if Griffin wins because votes were disposed of, and those voters would have also voted for people who legitimately won their races but may not have in the absence of those votes, couldn't the losers in those contests come back and sue to have those people removed?
What I was saying is it would be difficult. And most of these, unless it's a statewide race, there wouldn't be all that many votes affected. And so it would be, that would be kind of uncharted territory, them trying to reopen seats that have already been settled at this point. So I think it's unlikely that in the 2024 round, a lot of other elections would be affected.
But, so Miles, I have about 45 seconds left. If Griffin wins, how would that impact future elections and elections challenges or the way in which rules governing voting are written and enforced around the country?
I think it honestly would just open the floodgates. I mean, the floodgates were opened in 2020 to this new playbook of losing candidates feeling emboldened to challenge their results. And there have been, I think there was some evidence in 2024 that maybe the genie was going back in the bottle a little bit. I think this would, it would just incentivize losing candidates to do everything they could to overturn the election.
And if he loses, Rusty, what happens then? Does it go? Did the Republicans ask for a Supreme Court to step in, or what? Quickly.
I think that what will happen is the legislature, the Republican-led legislature, will look at all the issues and they will start legislating in a way that gets the rules in place.
And we are out of time. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.